Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice, fair use, successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. And Don Schwartz, our guest, is an actor and journalist. His book, Telling Their Own Stories, Conversations with Documentary Filmmakers, is available from Amazon. His film reviews and filmmaker profiles appear regularly in CineSource magazine. And Don holds BA, MA, and PhD degrees in psychology and counseling. And Carol, I just want to say welcome, Carol and Don, to the first of an ongoing series of Dissecting Docs. And so I was wondering, what films will you cover today, Carol?
Well, we're reviewing six documentaries from First Run Features and HBO. We're covering a food doc, a mystery, a controversial subject, organ trade, a brilliant biography, a very sweet dance film, and Tales from the Script, which is part of a six CD series on filmmaking. That is fantastic. So, Don, since you're the one who writes these incredible reviews of documentary films, I want you to go first and to tell us what you think about the film. Then I'm going to comment like the audience, because I see over 300 docs and doc trailers a year. So I think that I have some insights onto what what to watch and what not. I know people are so restricted with time these days that when you say it's a 90-minute doc feature, everybody goes, oh, I can't do that. Yes, you can. There's some great films out there, and you shouldn't miss them. So that's what this show's all about, to give you some guidance and overviews so you can choose what to watch. Okay, Don, so give us your critique of the first film, The Raw and the Cooked.
Thank you, Carol, and thanks for this opportunity. The Raw and the Cooked is a culinary journey through Taiwan. Most of the documentaries I see are difficult subjects, challenging subjects. And The Raw and the Cooked is one of the few films I get to see that's totally fun. It is directed by Monica Triet, and I have to spell her name, her last name, because I don't know how to pronounce it. She's German. Monica Triet, T-R-E-U-T. And Monica is a prolific filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, and I would say she's on the verge of being legendary. A couple of her docs cover edgy subjects of sexuality, so I think that's one of the reasons of her legend. And this one totally took me by surprise. Having seen her other films, I did not expect to see Monica Triet traveling Taiwan and simply enjoying their food. And that's what this is all about. And it is delicious to look at, and it's very tempting. You should watch this film when you're not hungry and then enjoy a big meal after that. So she goes
to...
There's
a lot of good recipes in there, Don.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. And so Monica goes to different regions of Taiwan, and then the food is tied to that region, the recipes. And she also covers some challenging topics too. She goes into the national issues of urbanization, pollution, nuclear waste that affects the agriculture, obviously, and affects. It's going to affect the cuisine. But the focus is not on that. The focus is on the cuisine itself primarily. And that's one of the films I'm definitely going to see more than once. As a result of seeing the film, I have added a culinary tour of Taiwan to my bucket list.
That's a good thing to do. But didn't you find that when she took you to meet the natives or to go out in the country and see where the food came from, that you really enjoyed watching them cook the food and serve it more? I mean, you really got to see where the food was grown and meet the farmers. I always love that. I go to my farmer's market every Sunday. I want to know who grew my food and what's in it.
Absolutely. I mean, everything about this film was just perfect as for what it's intended to do, and in terms of remembering the scenes that stick with you, I have to add that she spoke with an American who was living in Taiwan for quite a while, and he was committed to a very healthy agriculture. So he set up. A system by which all his excrement was saved in large barrels to be turned into compost. Yeah. And you get to see, he introduces you to the years-long process each barrel goes through that ends up with perfect soil.
It's amazing. That was an amazing part of it. But the cooks, I mean, everybody there seemed to really love the art of cooking.
And Monica Triet loved the food she got to eat. I was so jealous.
It's true. Well, I saw them when they were in the temple and when they were making food in the wok and how they cooked the ginger. I learned so much from them. Very simple recipes I learned, and they are delicious. So I think that if you are a foodie, if you love the Food Network, this is a terrific film for you. You get to see the island of Taiwan, get to learn about the natives, some of the history that I'd never heard of before, and you feel like you know Taiwan and you know the food. And Don, when you ask anybody, what is there to do in Taiwan? What is there to see or do? And they say, the food. It's the best place for food in all of Asia, right? Have you heard that?
That's what documentaries are all about. I had no idea, no concept of this. And now I'm educated.
Right. I'm the same as you. I recommend this film, particularly for those who are looking for more information about Asian food, how to cook it, how to serve it, and you just enjoy meeting all of those cooks in Taiwan. Okay, let's go to the second film. What did you think of the documentary Herb Lock?
I loved it. And one of the things I do when I think about a film after I watch it is what feeling does it leave me with? Herb Lock is essentially a biography of Herbert Block, who was a legendary, and his legend continues, editorial cartoonist. And I never even thought of biographies of editorial cartoonists. And this film is different from most of the documentary films I see in that it was made with a very high budget. It's very sophisticated. And I do not mean to damn with high praise here. I just mean to say that they did they covered Herbert Block's life with reverence. And I left the film with that feeling, a deep appreciation and a reverence for a man I never heard of and never knew about until I saw this film. And Herbert Block, this film covers the professional life of Herbert Block mostly through the second half of the 20th century. And it shows how he became an editorial cartoonist and how he covered difficult cultural political issues. He was ahead of the curve in terms of anticipating issues, including the Vietnam War, including the Civil Rights Movement. And he didn't hesitate to come up against his editors and publishers. And if he had a political stance that disagreed with the editorial or a publisher, the editor or the publisher, he would provide the cartoon.
And they would publish it too, Don. That's what was so shocking, is that he had a handshake for most of his life, an agreement that they would just publish his cartoon, and no one could, they could not say no. So, and in the film, they did talk about where one time he had a cartoon that was pro, and the editorial was against an issue. I mean, they were in, they both took opposite stands. But that was allowed, and that's what freedom of the press is all about, don't you think?
Absolutely. And then there's the personal angle here, because after seeing the whole film, I got the sense of Herbert Block as a very kind and gentle man. So he was what I would call a quiet warrior.
Absolutely.
And that contrast is fascinating. So I want to make sure I get this in. It was written, produced, and directed by Michael Stevens, who obviously is a very prolific filmmaker. And Stevens includes everything in this film, interviews of American journalists and broadcasters, historians, editors, publishers, satirists, and a few people who knew Herbert Block personally. So you really get a sense after seeing this film that you know Herbert Block. And you know his contribution to American culture and American politics.
Absolutely. I felt like that, and I thought, how did I miss this guy? I was busy running a business in those days, and I always read the first page of the Wall Street Journal, but I never got into the area where he was with editorial and content. But he, as an editorial cartoonist, he was literally inside the minds of many of our readers, because the film showed us that since they showed us some of the cartoons, and then they explained things that have come out since he created the cartoons, such as the tapes of what was being said in the Oval Office, and that was exactly what Herb Block had depicted in one of his cartoons, exactly what was going on in the Oval Office, as if he was inside their minds. He could understand the feelings of the people in power and the dilemmas and the dilemma of the problems that the country was facing, and how they had these major decisions to make and choices. And he depicted that in his cartoons. But anyway, his work is a treasure.
Right. I want to respond to what you said earlier. How did I miss this guy? That's exactly how I felt. Just somebody that's so important and had such an impact, I never heard of him. And that is what documentary films are all about. They bring us to worlds and characters and people that we never heard of. And how would we ever hear of them unless we actually saw the film?
Exactly. It's a major historical document, and I'm so glad they put so much money and time into it to give us such a complete history of his work. But see, I love the way he created the character for the atomic bomb. It's truly a brilliant representation of the power of the bomb. And he would put the bomb in cartoons, and he would put the bomb at the table when people were negotiating, because that's what was on their minds. The power, who had the power, who's sitting on the bomb, who can destroy whom. The bomb was in every meeting and on all agendas. And then my favorite, I have to tell this one, was the picture of the United Nations building, and on the side of the building was the shadow of the bomb, because it affected the entire world, and particularly was hanging over decisions made by the United Nations. So the bomb was controlling lives, and it really might have gone unnoticed had he not brought it from the consciousness, from people's back part of their minds into the consciousness by creating the bomb as a character. I enjoyed
right.
that.
And if only we responded to the messages he was giving so early on. He was giving those messages very early.
Yeah, he could tell the whole editorial story in one cartoon. So that's why people would grab the paper, look at his picture, analyze it, know exactly what was going on in the consciousness of America on that day and what the main issue was. Then they could read the editorial and believe in it or not, because they had guidance from her about all aspects of that issue. He usually put them in the cartoon. So I thought it was really a great biography, and I highly recommend it.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So now let's go to the lovely dance film, Ballroom Confidential, by Brian Lilla. What did you think of that?
Yeah, Brian Lilla is a very talented young filmmaker, and he had a home run with his first feature, Patagonia Rising. It got distributed by First Run, and that's not an easy thing to do when you're a young filmmaker coming out with a first feature. And he traveled to Patagonia to cover the conflict over the damming of rivers that affect Patagonia. And he took a very poetic look at it. It was just physically beautiful. The topic is heartbreaking, the loss of a beautiful world due to the damming of rivers and the putting in of various kinds of infrastructure, wires, electricity, towers. And then, so I got to review that film, and I enjoyed it. And then I asked him what's next, and he said a ballroom film. And I was a little bit surprised, which is quite a shift from this somber, challenging subject to Ballroom Confidential. And I love this film. Brian Lilla does not do narration. There's no narration in the film. And it's about a ballroom, a dance studio in Ormond Beach, Florida. And there is a clientele at this dance studio. They're a woman of a certain age, and in my review I say for instance, in their 80s. The teachers there write and put on a dance choreography show called In Search of the Daytona Diamond. And there is a large group of women who rehearse, practice, and put on this show. And Brian's film covers the story of the studio, but more importantly, the rehearsal and performance of the show. And there's lots of interviews with the dancers. And I would say that this film is a really touching story, and it confronts us with what we think is possible and not possible as we age. And there's one thing I want to say about it, too. One of the points made by one of the dancers is that there are therapeutic effects on Alzheimer's for learning ballroom dancing. And I found that surprising, obviously. And when I heard that, I put the film on pause, and I went to Google, and I typed in Alzheimer's and ballroom dancing and came up with more than 240,000 results.
Wow.
So that whenever I speak of this film, I always mention there's something about ballroom dancing and aging and improving your brain. So I made
they
a mental...
They also give some statistics about people who dance and the longevity and
mm-hmm.
how much better it is to dance than not to dance.
Absolutely. So I made a mental note, I want to learn salsa.
Well, I never knew how beneficial dancing was till I saw this film. And I was thinking about the filmmaker as I was watching it, and I realized that he must have had an enormous amount of footage because he did lots of interviews, brilliant, brilliant, in-depth interviews where you felt so close to the person. He took you in their homes. He didn't do a sterile interview where you're sitting against a blank wall or whatever. He went into the homes. He interviewed them while they were cooking their food or while they were dressing themselves or while they were sewing their costumes. we got to meet the people involved in the dance contest by going in and learning what was their other hobby besides dancing. I had a great experience. You're never bored. But the point with the editing is that he must have
had... The family has a long history of doing things their own way.
A tremendous amount of footage, and he did an excellent job editing it.
Yes.
So, Khalib, the dance instructor, sincerely cared about the women. And that sincerity and that love came right into your living room. And the dedication that these women had for their dancing was incredible. I loved going into their homes, watching the costumes. I mean, they were all so proud of the clothes, the shoes, the hats, the gloves, the accessories. Unbelievable. Every detail matched, and they had... for heaven knows how long, but they all look stunning. And what I got from it was that they were in good health, active, mentally alert, well-dressed, well-cared for. In other words, this gave them a lot of self-esteem, Don. Dancing improved their outlook on life. Many of them had lost their partners, and they carried on dancing even without them. So I recommend the film, especially if you like to dance or if you're into exercise. You might find that it's not too late to learn to dance. One of the men started in his 60s, so that's good news.
Yeah, I also love the backstory about how this film got made. Patagonia Rising was quite a daunting challenge for Brian Lilla, and when he finished it, he just wanted to take a break. But his mother asked him to please shoot what's going on with her ballroom teacher in the ballroom studio, dance studio. And so he reluctantly said yes, and it was a one-man show. He shot it and edited it, produced it, and his mother, who was one of the dancers, was one of the co-producers.
It's family, love, friendship, fun, exercise, how to enjoy your life. I mean, that's what we all should be doing. Too many of us work too hard, we're tired, and we don't have that hobby or that extra thing that we look forward to. So this is not that hard to add dancing to your bucket list, is what I say.
Yeah, Brian Lilla is one of the documentary filmmakers I was able to interview, and I'm just really, really happy for him, and I look forward to more from him.
Well, he hit a home run with this film in my book.
Yes.
I became a fan. Now, let's go to the Argan Trade, Doc. Tell me what you thought of that.
Right. Oh, so we're back to... from what is for me the more typical documentary that covers a difficult, challenging, painful issues. This film is called Tales from the Organ Trade, and it is directed by a woman whose first name is Rick, R-I-C, and I have to spell the rest of her name, Rick Esther Bienstock. I really want to make sure I get the name right of the directors. R-I-C is the first name, Esther, E-S-T-H-E-R, and Bienstock is B like a boy, I-E-N-S-T-O-C-K. And I apologize, I don't know how to pronounce her first name, so I'm going to just go with her last name, Bienstock. She traveled the world, and she was covering the issue of the commercial trade of human kidneys. And she interviewed donors and recipients and doctors and others involved with the trade. And the problem she was covering is that there's a lot more need for kidneys than there are kidneys available. And there is a black market in kidneys, and very poor people are giving up their kidneys in very unhealthy circumstances for people that have the money to purchase them. And so I've known that organ trade is an issue, but I was very, very far away from that trade. But this film does, and brings you into the middle of that trade, and it brings you into the middle of the issue of selling organs for money. And And it comes up with a solution. The problem is that it's against the law to sell organs, and therefore you have this black market. And the proposed suggestion is simply to create a regulated way that people can sell their kidneys, because the information that the film provides that there are enough kidneys for the people that are in need of kidney transplants. And then if a regulated way of doing it could be found, that would solve the problem. And this is another film that brings you into a world you knew existed, but you didn't want to know about it probably, or didn't care about it. And after seeing this film, I cared about the issue.
Well, so did it convince you that there should be some regulation put in so that we can people can sell their organs and they can be then doled out to those in need? Did that convince you?
Absolutely. When I heard the various aspects of the kidney trade, I heard the solution, it seemed imminently obvious. And
okay.
I felt frustrated and I felt furious that it wasn't happening now.
Exactly what they wanted you to think. But we have to, this is where I really got, I went into shock, because now I realize how much watching documentaries, I rely on them. They usually tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly. They give you all sides of an issue, and I need that. I mean, I'm going into a doc usually with not enough information on the subject, and I'm expecting them to give me both sides of the issue, and that's what a good documentary does. This documentary doesn't do that. In this film, they're promoting the sale of organs, and in fact, the end of the film, they actually imply and ask for you to support this agenda for transplants. Now, let's go to inside the film, because in the film, you see people living in cardboard shacks, literally cardboard shacks with no running water, no electricity, and they're waiting to sell a kidney so they can get some money to support their family. So they make a very good case for the money. In other words, they're saying these poor people need the money. They can move out of the cardboard shack into a little house, and so we think it's okay. But almost everyone we followed was in dire poverty, awaiting news from their agent that the donors, they had found a donor that matched their body language and that they could buy their kidney. So all they did, though, this is the era in the film, in my opinion, is they only followed people who had successful kidney transplants. And you also heard that without this kidney, that person would die. It's as if there is no alternative. It's transplant or death. And that's what they said in many cases. But here's the truth that I know from a woman I work with. She's in my intentional filmmaking class. She's been on dialysis for 39 years. She is a mother, a wife, a food person. She does a food blog. She is a cook. She is a filmmaker making a film about living on dialysis. So she has a full life, and she's been on dialysis for 39 years. And so what's the difference here? Well, number one, she's glad she has dialysis, and her mental attitude is that it is a way of life for her. What about transplants? Well, she got on the list. She waited 3 years. She had a transplant. It didn't work. She had to heal from that operation. She went through all the trauma. So she puts her name on the list. She waits. She gets a transplant. Second transplant does not work. Third transplant doesn't work. Now, my point is the film only showed successful transplants. It did not discuss unsuccessful transplants. So what is the percentage of those? And how many people go through the expense, the illness, the sorrow, the loss? Because kidneys are all about loss. And when you study the body, the Chinese say that kidneys represent loss. So for people to keep losing their kidneys is even more loss in their life. Anyway, through all the trauma, she goes back and starts using her dialysis and goes on with her life. And her attitude is, I think, what's saving her life. But my only statement is that we ought to be told more information on the other side. We didn't know how many or what the percentage of transplants are that fail. We never saw one person in there who was living happily on dialysis because they knew that it improved their life, and they were all waiting. That is no way to live. So I will just tell you what the World Health Organization opposes: all efforts to legalize human organs. And I totally agree with him because I think they recognize the dangers apparent with putting a price on human lives, and especially in poor countries where there's little police protection and you become a target. Places like Malaysia, can you imagine if they were selling or buying organs in the United States and they would pay, say, $2,000 for a kidney or $2,000 for a lung? Man, those people would just disappear overnight, and they would be flying out lungs and kidneys galore. And that's not what it's all about. I don't think a human life should have a dollar amount put on it. That's my opinion. And that really, this film did not tell us the whole story.
Okay. Well, we could talk a lot longer about the film, but that's the purpose of films, to get you to talk about it.
That's right. That's right.
I want to add that this film is narrated by sophisticated horror meister David Cronenberg.
Yes. Technically, it was a well-made film. I have nothing wrong. It was only the content that shook me up. But let's go on to something more exciting: An Unreal Dream by Al Rinich, John Dean, and Nellie Gonzalez. What did you think about this film?
Right. So this is the film that's been haunting me ever since I saw it. I would say this is the most haunting, stunning film I've seen in the last year. And it was directed by his name is Al Reinert, as I read it, R-E-I-N-E-R-T. And it's called An Unreal Dream, The Michael Morton Story. Michael Morton is a husband and father. He was at work in a big city in Texas. And he got a phone call at work from the police telling him that his wife had been brutally murdered. He was then investigated, charged, indicted, and convicted, and imprisoned for 25 years for the murder of his wife. His 3-year-old child was taken away from him. He was imprisoned for 25 years. The Innocence Project took many years, but they got him out after 25 years of being in a Texas prison. Reinert's film tells this story, and for part of the story is told by Michael Morton himself. They placed him in the middle of the courtroom in which he was convicted, alone except for the film crew, and he tells a story, and then Reinert interviews a large number of people, including the son that was taken away from him, and the Innocence Project people, and prisoners that knew Michael Morton. And this film is extremely haunting to me. And what haunts me is not the story, because the story, sadly, is not that unusual. But what's haunting is the character of Michael Morton. And this is a film that brought out my frustration, that when I write a review and it gets published, of course I would love people to see it, and I don't know how many people see a film because I write a review, but this is a film that made me wish I could just say, see this movie, and people would go see the movie.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I really enjoy this film because it moves at a good pace. It has brilliant interviews. You're totally involved in the murder, and you're constantly wondering if Martin is guilty or not. You know, did he really do it, is in your mind. But here's the thing. you feel it from the very beginning, this essence, there's this wonderful essence to this film. It grabs you, it brings you in. And when you know, you can read on the cover what happened, and, you know, it tells you the end and what's happening today, which most of the time would spoil something. It doesn't. In this instance, the filmmaker grips you and pulls you into the story, and you feel like you're on this roller coaster ride with Michael Martin himself. And this is a man who is most articulate. He somehow did not seem to pick up the vocabulary of the people that he probably was in jail with, nor the mannerisms. He maintained his integrity and his environment. Even in that horrible environment, he maintained who he was. He didn't lose the face of who he was, I found. So I like this film, the places they chose for interviews, the photography. The descriptions Martin has of living in jail are so raw and so real that you know what it must have been for a normal person to be at home with his family one day and locked up the next, and the continued confinement year after year, and the noise in those jails. I mean, he let us realize what the smell was like, what the sounds were like. And how the only way to get away from the sound, he would put earphones on and listen to things. And he survived. But the most important thing is when you look at his picture on the cover, he doesn't look like a man that's been imprisoned, who was wrongfully accused. He looks like a very happy man. So I think this is a story of forgiveness and how healing and the act of forgiveness is healing, not only to the individual who forgives, but to those around you. And this energy of forgiveness is supposed to be the highest vibration on the planet, according to David Hawkins, who wrote Power Versus Force. He says that forgiveness is the highest vibration on the planet, and that getting to that stage can bring you bliss beyond belief. And that is actually what I see on Martin's face. He's in a state of bliss. He loves his life. What's gone is gone. He's here now and for tomorrow. And so I know a lot about Texas because I grew up there. And I know how when there was a robbery or a murder, my mother used to tell me, don't worry, they'll have somebody locked up by dark. And they would, whether it was the right person or not, didn't always matter. Anyway, I think for an event that has already happened where you know the results, this is an excellent film. If you want to listen to a good murder mystery, this is it.
Yes, they do solve the mystery, too. You know, and so... Yes, we know the plot of the film. Innocent man jailed, gets out after 25 years. But you cannot know the character of Michael Morton without seeing this film. And it is about the character of this man.
Well, and yes, and there's a chunk there, a lot of twists and turns in this. There are hooks. You couldn't write a better script, really. This has all those shocking moves and changes, and there's some brilliant ones in this film that we can't reveal, but you will really find interesting and important.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because are you there?
I just wanted to let you know that we have about 10 minutes left, so want to make sure that we have a chance to cover all the films.
Okay,
we only have one more, but go ahead, Don. Tell us what you were saying.
Oh, I would say that, I'll let it go. Let's go on to the next film.
Okay.
I don't want to give short shrift to Tales from the Script.
Oh, this is the best package, The Art of Filmmaking, and it's five revealing documentaries. It is wonderful. I'd already seen some of them before I got the package, and I'm so glad. It's Directors, Life Behind the Camera, Sven Nyquist, Light Keeps Me Company. That we'll do Sven's documentary on our next show in May. Capturing Reality, the Art of the Documentary, and you get a little bonus here, Lavender Limelight, Lesbians in Film. That's what the six docs are. So we're going to start today with Tales from the Script. And I'm telling you, what a great film this is. So, Don, you take it from here. Tell us what you thought as a review.
Okay, well, this is all about the world of script writing for Hollywood movies. It is directed by Peter Hansen, and he interviews just a large number of writers, some much more successful than others, one of the most successful ones being William Goldman. And I want to just give this quote from at the beginning of the film. It's by writer Billy Ray. "This is a last business. If you can survive as people are kicking you in the head, eventually their leg will get tired. If you're still there and can pull yourself up to your feet, you get the last laugh." Hansen,
that's it.
Hmm?
That is it in a nutshell.
It. Mm-hmm. And so Hansen gives us a lot of interviews. One of the special features of the film is an additional 47 minutes of interviews. So after seeing this film, you get this vision of the world of Hollywood script writing, and I'm interested to see what you think, Carol. It seems like an utterly chaotic, roulette-like reality that's a function of personality, and a function of caprice, and a function of just unseen forces that affect how and why a script eventually gets read, and if it gets made. And I just was, as the film went on and I heard each writer talking about their experiences, I just got extremely overwhelmed. I just started breathing heavily. I became exhausted at what they had to deal with.
It's true. Everything in there is true. I hear it. I see it. I know it.
So you know, I love shows about Hollywood, looking at the man behind this curtain. In this case, the hundreds of people behind the curtain, and the Tales from the Script that brings you to that world, and it gives you some appreciation for what goes on. And one of the themes of the film is that the writers provide the backbone, the substance of a movie, and everybody else gets paid more.
Well, just surviving in Hollywood as a writer is a brilliant achievement. Now, I'll tell you, thank you, First Run Features. I really appreciate them for putting together this package because it's perfect for a filmmaker. You've got lighting, you've got documentary filmmaking, you've got directing and script writing. It's fabulous. And in Tales from the Script, it is very much like Tales from the Crypt. I mean, these are horror stories of brilliant writers talking about what they had to go through and are still going through. It also tells you how things have changed in Hollywood and not for the better for writers. But we hear from writers like Scott Frank, who wrote Get Shorty. That's one of my favorite films. Ron Sheldon, Bull Durham. William Goldwyn, many, many films, but No Way to Treat a Lady is one of them. Paul Schrader, Taxi Driver. Antoine Fisher. And of course, the Antoine Fisher story. He tells us how he was trying to pitch his film, and his mouth got so dry he couldn't even talk. And of course, they loved him and they took the film. But boy, was he lucky! My favorite year, Dennis Palumbo is a great writer. So I know that in recommending this, you will find one of your favorite writers in this series because you can't help it. There's too many in there. But you're going to hear statements like, "Hollywood is made of a group of people. And if you put them all together like a totem pole, you'll find that the writers are on the bottom part that you stick in the ground. They want they can't do without you, but they don't want to hear from you. Give me the script and get out of the way. And Goldman says that you can't stop. When you start writing, you can't stop because you get pissed on or rejected. Nobody wants to give you the first shot. They don't want to take a risk, right? So you just have to keep going, keep going. And when I interviewed Jeff Garden, the owner and manager of the Writers Boot Camp, he says when you finish your first script, Don, you are only 7% to completion. You finish the first draft, 7%. You have 93% more work to do, okay? So it is not an easy profession. But many people think that they can just write a script and that's it. You need a beginning and an end. And in Get Shorty, they ran a clip from there where they were saying how simple it is. You don't really need a good writer. And so he says to the writer, then what do I need you for if I can write a script myself? And this is what most people in Hollywood think, that it's an easy thing to do. But it isn't. It's a sincerely complicated, highly professional, highly skilled job. And if you just read one other book, that would be Save the Cat. I'll promise you, if you put in an hour in that book, and then you tell me that you think writing a script is an easy job, I'll tell you, I'll fly you to the moon on that statement. No way. So anyway, there's just so much to learn about writing a script that you put all this time and effort into learning the craft, and then you start writing. And as one man showed us, he'd sold 3 scripts, but he had written about 25. And so the number of scripts you sell versus the number that you option versus the number that you write, the list of the scripts that you write is about 10 times more than any of these, than what you sell or what you get optioned. It seems that nobody wants your stuff. These are some of the chapters. I have to share this with you because I love the chapter headings. He didn't do this in the normal documentary style. He used a chapter outline. So one chapter is food stamps and good wishes. And the truth is a lot of writers live on food stamps until they sell something. Another chapter, nobody wants your stuff. Breaking into the business is what that's about. And then there's a post-content era, the current climate in Hollywood. And in there they say that they're only making around 12 films a year. That doesn't give you a lot of room because they're doing sequels, and so for new content, there's very little room. Visitation rights is another one. I mean, once they get the script, they don't really care. They do let you go to the script meetings, but as one writer explained, that an employee of the production company can sit up all night coming up with one line to demoralize or to debase your script, and that's his job for the day, find one good complaint to make. And he throws that out in the meeting, and then you have to address that for hours. So you're up against a lot of creatives who want input and want to tear apart your script. And so one whole chapter is called Chopped and Mashed and Navigating the Development Process. And that is what you have to live through. That is the hard part. Now, my favorite was The Care and Feeding of Producers. The title of the chapters, Always Sit on the Couch, The Care and Feeding of the Producers. They say always wear flat shoes because most writers are taller than the producers, so you do not want to go in there with any, even a one-inch lift, forget it. You also sit on the couch. Do not sit in the comfortable chair. That's for the producer. So I love that part. The last quote I'll leave you with is, it is a hard way to make an easy living. That's what I loved it. I learned so much. And the one thing you will get from some of the top writers is if you can do anything else, don't get into script writing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, good advice.
I'd like to just emphasize that this film tells from the script, and the five film box set is for everybody. If you love movies, you will love going behind the scenes and seeing where they come from.
Exactly. It's a good buy. I agree with you. And so we'll do Sven Nyquist next time, because this is the master of light and photography. He's brilliant. And we'll do another five more docs along with it. Okay, Don?
It's a deal.
Okay. So,
all right. Well, before we go, let's just make sure that everybody knows how to get in touch with Don, your contact information or website, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely. They can just go to donschwartz.com.
Okay, good.
donschwartz.com.
Yes.
And on the Blog Talk Show, we will have his the information on where you can read his reviews.
Okay.
It's really
wonderful.
Important to support documentarians. There are less vestige of creative, unbiased reporters. So download docs. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Claire.
Well, thank you,
yes.
too.
Thank you. It's wonderful. Be
All
well.
Right. Till next time.
Bye.
Bye. I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.